Welcome back to the special Beatles show here on the Derek Hunter Show on WBAL. 50 years ago today, the boys landed up at JFK. Sunday is the anniversary of the Ed Sullivan Show, and Tuesday is the 50th anniversary of their first North American concert in Washington, D.C., just up the road. And joining me now is probably the big... I thought I was a Beatles fanatic. I got nothing on this guy. You know him from the Fox News Channel. His name is James Rosen. He's a real journalist down there. But more than that, we're going to ask him to put his objectivity aside and show his screaming teenage girl side here about the Beatles. James Rosen, how are you?
It was ever thus, Derek. It really was. And,
you,
I don't hide from... I don't shrink from that.
No, you don't. You know, I'd heard from my fiance that you were a Beatles fan. And, you know, okay, I know lots of Beatles fans, but I'm a Beatles fan, too. And I thought, well, it'd be very interesting to talk to James Rosen. So we had breakfast, and you are not a fan. You are an encyclopedia. How did you first become obsessed with the lads from Liverpool?
First, we've buried the lead. I didn't realize you were engaged, so congratulations.
Oh, that has changed since our breakfast. Thank you.
That's awesome.
Same girl, too.
Look, I grew up in New York City in the 70s, which is a kind of a media-saturated place. I have a brother who's 5 years older than me, and so he was seven in 1970, and mostly probably simply to torture me. Eric used to say to me, you know, you missed the 60s, you missed everything, you missed the Beatles, you missed Muhammad Ali, you missed Woodstock, you missed the moon landing, you missed the Amazing Mets. And so I grew up under the belief, and I'm still not disabused of it, that I just missed this truly epic era.
Especially when the 70s are your frame of reference. God, the 70s were awful. So hear all the good times you missed.
I'm reminded of the scene in Dazed and Confused where Ben Affleck and they're all sitting around and they say, gosh, the 70s suck. Aren't the 80s going to be so much greater than this? the first Beatles song I heard was 8 Days a Week, and it just hooked me immediately. And to this day, I still really do love, I mean, I love all of their work, but I still love the early music. A lot of Beatle fans I know really are only interested in the work that comes off of Rubber Soul and beyond.
Mm-hmm.
But if I were, aside from wishing to see my family, if I were sentenced to spend the rest of my life in a white padded room just listening to With the Beatles on repeat endlessly, I don't think I'd be terribly upset.
That'd be a way to get to a white padded room, too, James Rosen.
But yeah, but just to say so.
Let's talk about the teeny bopper years versus the, we'll call them, for lack of a better word, cerebral years, the drug years, I guess we could also call them. They forget the Beatles against the Beatles back then and think about the state of songwriting, because not only are you a Beatles fanatic, you're sort of a musical encyclopedia. And if you look at the art of songwriting and what Lennon McCartney did to the art of songwriting, it started off, gee, I love you, girl, and we're all swell, and let's hold hands and kiss, to lyrics that are, you know, they could either mean nothing, they could be about politics, revolution, social commentary, as the case with Blackbird. They evolved, and songwriting in general evolved with them.
True, but it would be, I think, a mistake to limit our conception of songwriting solely to the lyrics. The chord changes and chord progressions that the Beatles were employing, even in their earliest songs, were quite arresting.
Did Leonard Bernstein not compare them to Beethoven?
I believe he might have. I know he wrote the introduction for a coffee table book about the Beatles in 1978, and that might be where he did that. But the Beatles were greatly indebted to other songwriters and musicians and musical acts of their time. They worshipped, as you know, Elvis, Chuck Berry, Little Richard, the Everly Brothers, and others from the first great wave of rock and roll. Let's not forget what the Beatles were when they first met each other and started to make music together. They were students.
Mm-hmm.
It's my belief that what made the Beatles' early songs so great and provided the foundation for the later sophistication you referenced is that they were, in fact, the keenest students of the first great wave of rock and roll. They paid the closest attention and discerned, as no one else did, exactly what made a great pop song great, from melody to hand claps to backup vocals. And, of course, Ringo Starr provided a truly unique and revolutionary style of drumming that was unlike anything that had been seen in pop music before the Beatles. And I think that... even Bob Dylan has said that he was driving cross-country in 1964, And everywhere he kept going, wafting with different radio stations wafting in and out of reception on his car, he kept hearing A Hard Day's Night and the other early Beatles songs. And he said the chord progressions they were doing were just outrageous. And he recognized instantly that this was a major musical force.
It really was. And just to geek out totally on the songwriting and the arrangement, the lyrical arrangement on the song Help, where the background vocals precede the lead vocals and then follow them in some cases.
Very sophisticated.
It was unique for the time.
But, again, I only mentioned the first great wave of rock and roll. There were other acts that were rising to the fore after that first great wave had subsided, when we saw Elvis drafted into the Army and Little Richard retire into the ministry and Buddy Holly tragically killed in a plane crash and Chuck Berry went to jail for violating the Mann Act. Jerry Lee Lewis was ostracized for having married his cousin and so forth. That whole first great wave seemed somehow to wash out within a few years. The period that immediately followed and immediately preceded the arrival of the Beatles on the scene is usually relegated to some sort of dark ages in literature on this subject. But in fact, it was a period that saw the Everly Brothers continue to have great success, and also Motown. And also the Brill Building in New York, which is actually a pair of buildings on Broadway, where you had writers like Carole King and Jerry Goffin producing these extraordinarily tuneful songs. Burt Bacharach also active at that time. The Beatles soaked all of this up, particularly Motown and Goffin and King, and aimed very much to be like them and worked their songwriting styles, both lyrical and musical, into what they were doing. And just to push back in a minor way, Derek, as a demonstration of my teen girl crush fandom here, on the notion that the lyrics were all sophomoric at that point, the Beatles, John Lennon in particular, were students of wordplay as kids growing up. And even those early songs include examples of that wordplay that is fairly sophisticated for its time, such as, "It won't be long till I belong to you." "I've got arms that long to hold you." These were little plays on words that were unusual, I think, for the time.
They were, and they definitely progressed even further, James Rosen.
Much further, yes.
Beatles fanatic. Now, I talked to David Wilde earlier, and he brought up the songwriting aspects, and we covered that. In your opinion, as someone who has studied this and someone who is, you know, working on various projects pertaining to the Beatles in this time, could any other band in the British Invasion — the Beatles were the tip of the spear, and I say a good portion of the shaft as well — could any other band have led that? If the Rolling Stones came first, would it have been a completely different feeling to it?
I think eventually there would have been permeation of the pop charts, the American pop charts, by British acts. There, as we know from the history of the time, the Beatles led what turned out to be a kind of British invasion, in which we saw, before even the Rolling Stones succeeded here, the Dave Clark Five, Jerry and the Pacemakers, a group that was also managed like the Beatles by Brian Epstein, and which I believe to this day is the only music act in history whose first three singles went to number one, and Herman's Hermits and others. And I think that eventually the kind of sounds that were being produced in England would have permeated American charts. Another way of putting this is to say that rock and roll could not have remained an American monopoly forever. But the fact that the Beatles came first was fortuitous for the British acts, because not only were the Beatles peerless in their songwriting skills and truly brilliant musicians, but their style, their actual manner of speech, their looks, their manner, all of that made it much easier for them to knock the door down than other groups would have found had they been first.
Right, their personalities, their charm, all five. There wasn't a grumpy one, there wasn't an angry one. Everybody was very affable, but in a different way.
Very quick-witted. All four didn't suffer fools. One of the things that made the Beatles different, everything made the Beatles different, we have to keep in mind about the time, 1964, there were no rock and roll groups like the Beatles, i.e. those that wrote their own songs, were both harmony groups and instrumentalists, and to top it off, who of course were unique in the fashion sense that they were promoting at the time, or projecting, I should say, and also who refused to play the showbiz game, who answered inane questions with openly sarcastic responses. The Beach Boys may have who got their start pretty much at the same time. I believe the first Beach Boys single is released on the same day as the first Beatles single, October 1962. But the Beach Boys, of course, were a far more conventional act in most respects than the Beatles. But we should go on to point out that as the 60s unfolded, the Beach Boys and the Beatles considered each other to be their chief rivals in terms
and
of
inspired
experimenting
one another.
And feeding off each other, such that the album Pet Sounds, which is a classic, inspired Paul McCartney with a lot of the ideas that morphed into Sgt. Pepper. And by some accounts, Sgt. Pepper was so monstrous a success and so profound in its genius that it drove Brian Wilson into a long period of exile.
In insanity and staying in bed for a decade. Now, James Rosen, you have had an honor that not very many people have had, and that is to jam with Paul McCartney. It's not like you picked up guitar and started ripping off some riffs, but you tell us your close encounter of the awesome kind.
Well said. October 8, 2005. Who remembers?
roughly somewhere. I don't remember. Really, but
I sound like Howard. October 8, 2005.
Just don't tell us what you were wearing. That would be creepy.
That's another anniversary that's coming up in February, by the way, the 50th anniversary of the Liston Clay fight, which is a real landmark in American culture, too. Be that as it may, October 8, 2005, XM Radio headquarters here in Washington, D.C., Paul McCartney recorded about an hour and a half long session for a program called XM Artist Confidential, which is sort of like XM Radio's version of Unplugged.
Mm-hmm.
I pulled string upon string with friend of friend to get my wife and me into this taping. There were only 47 chairs in the studio, and it was just a baby grand piano and a stool where he was going to sit and play acoustic and take questions and that sort of thing from a moderator. And my wife and I were in the second row. Now, she had already been used to seeing me at concerts, at McCartney shows, weeping uncontrollably for long stretches at a time, because I can't handle the imminence of death upon this the phenomenon that is the Beatles. And this was not too long after George Harrison had died, which was something that had plunged me into deep depression at the time. In any case, Paul says at one point, he starts strumming his acoustic, and he says, "For this next number, could use some volunteers from the audience. Anyone feel like volunteering?" And I shoot both hands up, and he goes, "Okay, you." And then he picks two other people from the back, and as I'm making my way up to the front, my wife whispers into me with an expletive we can't say on the radio, "Keep your blankety together. You cannot weep on this." And I got up there. I did keep my blankety together, and I shook his hand, and I said, "Union wages, right?" He goes, "No, you're not going to get paid for this." And then he gave me a wink and delivered unto me a Liverpoolism: "Don't get above your station." And the other two people, he sat down on the piano bench. It turned out, I don't know if they were ringers, but they were at Juilliard or maybe the Peabody Conservatory in Baltimore, and they played piano, and I don't. And so he sat them on the keys, but that wasn't determined. And then he just stood me up by he sat them on the bench and stood me by the twinkly keys, and he instructed us what he wanted us to play. And then he physically took my hand and put my hand on the piano and instructed me just repetitively to play the same two twinkly notes, ching, 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 ching. "Now all of you do it together." And we all do it together, and he goes, "Softer, softer." And we all do it softer, and my mind is immediately plunged into take one of "I Want to Hold Your Hand," which the aficionados will have, in which you can hear them go, "Bom, bom, 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 bom." And you hear him say, "Ringo, softer, Ringo, softer." And here's Paul now saying to me, "Softer." And he said, now he's strapping on the acoustic, and he says, "Listen, you're going to be tempted once I start strumming to try and keep time with me. Don't try and do it, because I'm telling you now, you'll lose it. Just keep time with each other." So he starts strumming, and instinctively I start to try to keep doing ching, 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 ching to try and keep time with him.
Mm-hmm.
I lose it, as he predicted, within one revolution of the music, and this little British voice pops into my head and says, "Good God, man, just do what he told you. For dear life, just focus on the others." And we all start playing together, and when it did, it sort of created this rolling classical-style Rachmaninoff musical bed, which he then starts accompanying with the acoustic. It was the song How Kind of You from his album at the time, Chaos and Creation in the Backyard. I have the disc of this as it eventually aired on XM Confidential.
I imagine it's your ringtone.
and I have a still photograph that his personal photographer Bill Bernstein took that shows him strumming, and the three of us on the piano behind him. So I do indeed, as you suggest, Derek, plan to dine out on that story for the next 40 years. You know, when I recorded with Paul,
exactly.
40 minutes, you follow along. When I recorded with Paul, maybe this will get me a spot at the Fest for Beatles fans alongside Peter Asher or Donovan or.
I think you're a little bit more integral than Peter Asher was. But James Rosen, we are out of time. We could listen to you talk like an excited schoolgirl all night. But you have enjoyed a thrill that all the rest of us can only dream of, and we shall hate you in perpetuity for such dream. But we'll live vicariously through it thanks to your sharing of it. Thanks for your time today, James.
You already hated me.
Have a good one.